so excited I have a pulpit this morning. I haven't had one for like 10 years, and you can get a whole lot more. Very excited. We had to use my music stand for the projector, but welcome to this new location. If you get a chance to peek around, it's so fascinating, this building, and we've had a lot of fun setting up, cleaning up. Thank you to everyone who did that. In front of you, you'll see this morning the very familiar art of the group of seven. And it would probably be hard for you to spend much time in Canada and not encounter their work at some point. The group of seven was a school of Canadian painters from the early 20th century who began to explore and fall in love with the varied landscapes of Canada. And collectively, they agreed that the country's magnificent wilderness regions, they needed to be recorded in a painting style that captured the untouched beauty of the landscapes that inspired them. And 100 years later, right, these artists have become the most famous Canadian artists there is. They're national icons who have radically shaped Canadian identity and changed the way we see ourselves and our landscape. But it's worth noting to me, it's fascinating, before the group of seven came along, apparently Canadians largely considered their country unworthy of being captured in art. But the group of seven comes along and their radical interpretation of the vast wilderness of Canada, it's sowed the seed and Canadians began to love their own land. Today their paintings can fetch $1 million a piece. And I mean, it's easy to see why. Just look at their art. It's absolutely exquisite. It's imaginative. It's rugged. It's lonely. It's beautiful. It's kind of haunted and mysterious. And prior to the group of seven, European styles and influence were predominant in Canada. And these painters broke away from that and began to craft their own sort of landscape paintings. And they did that by traveling to Georgian Bay, Algonquin Park, other remote places throughout Canada, capturing the untouched, if you will, the unspoiled Northland. But I love that if you dig into their history, you realize that at the beginning, critics were very harsh with them. When they first appeared on the scene, critics didn't love their work. They called it too decadent for the post-World War I era. In fact, my favorite critique of theirs is one art critic said, their work is an insult to common decency, which, okay. I'm not sure how that works, but this didn't deter the group, and they kept painting, and again, have become icons. And whether or not you like the group of seven, they had a significant impact on Canadian identity. J. Russell Harper, one of Canada's leading art historians, he sums it up this way. The group of seven were not the first nationalists, but they were the first to make artists in the public listen and observe. It's made the group iconic and synonymous with Canada, and for many, they symbolize our identity. And it's worth reflecting to me how they achieved this. They simply connected us to our land. And by showcasing creative works of land and sky, Canadian identity moved a step forward. But it's interesting, there's hints of nationalism in the way they thought of themselves. Listen to this quote from Lauren Harris. Our art is founded on a long and growing love and understanding of the North in an ever clear experience of oneness with the informing spirit of the whole land and a strange brooding sense of Mother Nature fostering a new race and a new age. So the Canadian artist was drawn north. Very curious to me. There's definitely some nationalistic tones going on there. But again, the way they craft the Canadian identity was simply connecting us to our land. And land and identity, to me, are a fascinating thing to consider. And as I want to begin our journey through some of the most troubling aspects of the Old Testament, and my hope is that if we can understand the book well, the Old Testament, we can understand how it still speaks powerfully to us. But to do that, I think we need a firm understanding of how land and identity often go hand in hand. And if we don't get that when we come to the Old Testament, it will continue to baffle and bewilder us. And so to do that, I want to begin by trying, if I can, to understand the land through the eyes of some indigenous authors. Because to be honest, I really think the Old Testament and their idea of land has a lot in common with indigenous communities and how they understand land. Consider these words by Amblin Kwamalina of the Palaiku tribe in Australia. She explains this. Land means different things to non-Indigenous and Aboriginal people. The latter have a spiritual, physical, social, and cultural connection. Non-Indigenous people and landowners often consider land as something they own, a commodity to be bought and sold, an asset to make profit from, but also a means to make a living off or simply home. They develop land as if it was unfinished or raw. For Aboriginal peoples, land is much more than a place. The land owns Aboriginal people, and every aspect of their lives is connected to it. I think her assessment of the way we Westerns understand land is rather precise and on point here. And I don't want to say our concept of land is wrong per se, impoverished perhaps, but I want to showcase how the Old Testament is often foreign to us simply because we're looking at land through Western eyes. We don't understand land in the same way that indigenous communities or ancient communities often did. And again, I think her assessment is rather precise. Land to us is something we might own. So we have property, personal property. This belongs to me, and what happens on it is governed by me. I wanted to take the kids out to Webster's Falls. That's where Kristen and I got engaged. So I want to take the kids out there on a hike. And of course, Webster's Falls, they've taken down the stairs. It's impossible to get from the top down to the river at the bottom. So I decided I would park in Dundas and find my way along the river. And I was having trouble finding a way into the park. And so I discovered, well, that looks like a trail, but it had a big sign. So I just blasted through with the kids. But Zoe said, what did that sign say? I said, well, it said, no trespassing. And she said, what? We're trespassing right now? Daddy, we can't. We're breaking the law. We're going to get arrested. I said, I do not share that person's view of property. Unless it's my own property, in which case I do have more of a personal property thing. But I was like, really? I can't get into Webster's Falls because somebody's land happened to be blocking the way. I violated it, but it sort of sums up one of the ways we think about land. This is mine. If you want on it, you better ask. You better have permission. Or we might think of land as something, an asset to make a profit from. Buy a house, let's hope things, property values go up. Maybe it's our retirement plan. If you're a farmer, you work off the land to make a profit. Or it can be home to us. I just drove by, there was a big accident on 401, they were diverting people off, so I got diverted into Hespler, and I took a drive by my old house, 21A Thomas Street. And it's bizarre how going past your childhood home can sort of stir certain emotions, and there's a real connection for me to that one property, but what intrigues me is that our connection to land is often so small and personal, rather than social. And so we can see land as home, but it's often very narrow in the way we see home. Or we consider land a commodity to be experienced, whether it's paddling through Algonquin Park, hiking a trail in a national park, time at the cottage, traveling to a piece of land as a destination. We often view land as a commodity to be experienced and captured. I was on a trip with my brothers in May, and we were hiking through Death Valley, and we came to a place that's very near and dear to my heart. If you can put the next slide up. This is the cover from U2's Joshua Tree, which is definitively the greatest album of all time. It is divinely inspired. It is, everything about it is perfect. And so we're hiking, and we came to Zabriskie Point, which is where, well, not yet. Back. There we go. We came to where the shot was taken. Now, I want you to notice something. Notice where Bob was looking. He's looking to the side. And so I thought, there's four of us. There's four of them. We can recapture this photo. And so I had someone take a picture. This is what we ended up with. And I look absolutely ridiculous. Looking good. So I, you know, my brother's even wearing a Joshua Tree t-shirt. But I look awful. I also have a mustache there. It's just, it's bad news. And then my brother saw this and they started making fun of me. They thought it was an awful picture. So I said, get out. I'm taking one of my own. And this is me in the breeze at Zabriskie Point. I mean, it's just gorgeous, right? If you want a copy of that photo for your personal collection, I'm willing to share it with you. But it was weird because when we went there, it was about, oh my goodness, I can capture this photograph. I can grab a hold of this. I'm in the same place. I can get this great photo. And yet, there's something about land and beauty that when you get home and you look at your photos, it can never really be captured, right? And yet, we spend so much time trying to capture the beauty of it. Or consider a place like Antelope Canyon. Slot Canyon, U.S. Southwest, one of the most gorgeous slot canyons I've ever been in. I think it might be one of the most beautiful places in the world. It's been captured in film. It's become an Instagram sensation. 5 years ago, this next photo here from Peter Lick, it's called Phantom, a photo within Antelope Canyon. This photo sold for $6.5 million. And the interesting thing to me is this, that was 5 years ago, just five. And the thing is this, with the advancement in technology and cameras, essentially anyone can get the exact same photo for a much cheaper cost. But this idea of capturing something and how it becomes something we want to buy and obtain, interesting thing to me about Antelope Canyon is created a tension there because the land is on Navajo land. And it represents, of course, for the Navajo people, it represents work, a boom to their economy, bringing tourists in there. But it also makes them compromise their understanding of land. The journal Vox recently did an interview with a Navajo guide who takes people down into this canyon by the hundreds. And it was absolutely fascinating to hear what he said. Because his first thing was, he doesn't tell people that in reality, he's not allowed or not supposed to be down in that canyon. He said this, "We're taught not to be in caves because we see that as the water's home and the wind's home. I was taught that if you go in there constantly, it will affect you. Our elders advise that before entering any cave or canyon, you pause to collect your thoughts and consider what purpose you're serving by going inside. Antelope Canyon was formed by the water, the wind, the sand. It's a creation carved by nature, not by humans. It's believed that if you're not of sound mind before entering, then spiritually you too will get caught up in the whirlwind." I mean, consider that one line alone. It showcases how vastly different we see land. "Our elders advise that before entering any cave or canyon, you pause to collect your thoughts and consider what purpose you're serving by going inside." Have you ever in your life pause to consider why you're climbing in a cave or hiking in a park? I mean, very rarely do we actually stop and go, what's my purpose here? Well, it's beautiful. It's exciting. It's a cave. Who doesn't want to go in a cave? But I love this idea here that you have to be spiritually mature enough to handle certain landscapes. If you're not of sound mind, the beauty of it can overwhelm you, can harm you. And so it's an interesting thing to me that for many indigenous communities, again in the Old Testament as well, some land is just forbidden. Don't go there. It's too much. And we see these laws and taboos in the Old Testament as well. That mountain is sacred, holy. Don't touch it. Don't go there. Don't climb it. If you're not pure enough of mind, you risk yourself harm. Anthony, the Antelope Canyon tour guide, he sums up, I think, some differences here when he talks about Antelope Canyon. He says, "To me, it's a place of prayer. It's a place of creation. You can hear the heartbeat of the land. It's really hard to explain to non-native people how important land is to us. We cherish it more than life, really. Today, this place has become Walmart. People don't go there for the right reasons. They go because they see wonderful pictures on social media. I always hear people saying, I can mark that off my bucket list now. And I'm just like, really? That's all you got out of going there? When have we ever questioned whether we are visiting a piece of land for the right reasons? When have we ever asked ourselves, what is my motive for going here? I think for ancient and indigenous communities, land is so much more than just something you might own or make a profit from or experience or even call home. Land runs so much deeper than that. And it's often connected to the idea that God or the Creator entrusted and gave land to certain peoples. I was at Zion National Park, and my brothers and I wanted to hike Angel's Landing, and as we got in line to go on the bus, a park ranger was giving a stern announcement. Please don't hike Angel's Landing. Two people have died there in the last 2 weeks. We think there's a thunderstorm coming in. Angel's Landing is one of the places that gets hit most with lightning in the entire park, so we're advising you not to go. And, of course, that freaked us out. So on the bus ride, we're thinking, should we go? And we're like, well, we might be the only ones there. This could be risky. This could be dangerous. When we got off and eventually hiked it, we realized apparently everyone ignored the warning. There were hundreds of people climbing it. But what I was really interested in is as you take the bus in, there's a PA system announcement. There's sort of running commentary. And as we're in Zion, one of the announcements that came on was this. The PA system rang to life. It said, "Hello, my name is Ben Pickervit, and I'm a member of the Kabah Band of Paiute Indians. There are many places in Zion with Paiute names. We call this canyon Makuntaweep, meaning straight-up land. Zion is part of a larger area known as our traditional homeland. Our Creator placed us here to care for and protect this land, especially places where water, medicinal plants, animals, and minerals are found." And it so intrigued me, because the land for them is sacred not just because of its properties, but because the Creator placed them there to care for and protect it. We see the same idea at play in Canada's own Assembly of First Nations. Their statement says this: "We, the original peoples of this land, know the Creator put us here. The Creator gave us laws that govern all our relationships to live in harmony with nature and mankind. The laws of the Creator defined our rights and responsibilities. The Creator gave us our spiritual beliefs, our language, our culture, and a place on Mother Earth which provided us with all our needs. We have maintained our freedom, our languages, and our traditions from time immemorial. We continue to exercise the rights and fulfill the responsibilities and obligations given to us by the Creator for the land upon which we were placed. The Creator has given us the right to govern ourselves and the right to self-determination. The rights and responsibilities given to us by the Creator cannot be altered or taken away by any other nation." Notice again the connection between land, identity, and Creator. And for many indigenous communities, spirituality is rooted in a very specific location, a very specific ecosystem. And in the Bible, you see this in the Old Testament, very specifically with Israel. So there's this massive biblical intersection with indigenous spirituality. And I think to understand the Old Testament in any sort of meaningful way, we have to try to see what's happening there outside of Western eyes. Because if we don't, all we will see is bloody stories, gory stories. But if we can see something going on here, a connection between land and identity, then we might have eyes to start seeing these stories differently. So what I want to do is I just want to take a snapshot of land and directions in the Old Testament. Because if you notice where people are heading, it starts to speak powerfully, I think, to what's going on. So Hebrew story, of course, begins. Their first ancestors are placed in a garden. Things don't go well. They disobey. They violate the sacred order of the place. In doing so, they find themselves exiled. But watch what happens in terms of directions. After God drove them out of the garden, he placed on the east side of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword flashing back and forth to guard the way to the tree of life. They're driven east. Genesis 4, this is after Cain kills his brother Abel. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden, further east. Genesis 10, this is right after the flood. The region where they lived stretched from Mesha towards Sephar in the eastern hill country, heading east. And right at the beginning of the Tower of Babel story, the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. I think this is important. There's a migration happening. God has placed people in a specific location, but they're heading east. away from the land God had entrusted to them. But then enter Abraham. God calls him to leave his land and head west, back to the land God had given his ancestors. It's time to return to the land I gave you and entrusted to you. Time to start a story of redemption. And it starts with you, Abraham, returning west. Genesis 12, the Lord said to Abraham, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. In Genesis 13, the Lord said to Abraham after Lot had parted from him, look around from where you are, to the north and south, east and west. All the land that you see I will give you into your offspring forever. I'll make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. Go walk the length and breadth of the land, for I'm giving it to you. So Abraham went to live near the great trees of Mamre at Hebron, where he pitched his tents. There he built an altar to the Lord. Now, notice again in terms of ideas and language, what's being used here is the very same ideas and understandings many indigenous communities have of land. The Creator gave us this land, entrusted this land to us. And so Abraham heads back to reclaim the land that was given to his ancestors. And then we know what happens. They suffer from famine. They head to Egypt for refuge. They end up being enslaved there for 400 years. Then God frees them. Then what? It's time to head back to the land I gave you. Back to the land I entrusted to you. And that brings us to two of the most bloody and barbaric books of the Bible. Joshua and Judges. And what we see in these troubling books is war, brutality, apparently even God-ordained genocide. And even though I think there are a lot of good reasons to think that's hyperbolic, if we view this book through the lens of people telling their story post-exile, even if we do that, it remains troublesome. And I can't pretend that I can solve all the questions and doubts that these two books spring up on us, but I want to return there next week to look at some of those brutal stories. But for this week, I want to argue this. What we find in these books is not conquest, but a land reclamation project. That might be a bit far-fetched for you, but if you can understand land through the eyes of the ancients, this land was given to us, entrusted to us. And so you see this in Joshua. Be strong and courageous because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their ancestors to give them. Joshua 21. So the Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give their ancestors, and they took possession of it. And I realize for some of us, I think this might be just a mere curiosity in looking at scripture of the Old Testament. Okay, that's kind of interesting. But to say this, when we understand land and identity and the way that functions for many people groups, it adds a new twist to these stories, a twist I think that will help us navigate the intricacies of the Old Testament because it's so often misunderstood and misaligned. But if we can take our Western eyes and the way we think of land off for a moment, suddenly things start to come into sharper focus. And it certainly raises this question for me, is anything really different today? Because here's the thing, people fight over land a lot. Whether it's urban gang wars for city blocks, civil war between ethnic groups, land disputes between governments and indigenous communities, or big international disputes like Russia, Ukraine, people fight over land a lot. Land matters, and some are willing to kill or be killed for it. In fact, the University of Oxford just released a study. They did a study of all conflicts in the past 200 years, and they found that close to 60% of those conflicts all primarily were about land. And so when we come to this book, the Old Testament, it serves as a cautionary tale, as we're going to see. Because what happens is you can fight for land, you can take for land, things still don't always turn out so well, but I'm getting ahead of myself. What does this mean for us? Well, a few things. I would say first, on a biblical level, I've been harping on this. I think we owe it to Scripture to come at it earnestly and honestly and allow it to play on its own terms. And to claim that these books have no wisdom to impart to us seems rather naive to me. And so part of my message would be to implore us, these are cautionary tales that matter for here and now. Let's wake up to the story Scripture is telling. Because if we allow Scripture to play on its own terms, it will warn us, challenge us, give us hope. And so I think we have to set aside at a certain point our own critiques of Scripture in order to allow Scripture to critique us. Second, obviously this has many implications for how we see and perceive land, creation, the earth. And certainly understanding this should give us a much greater appreciation for our indigenous peoples, our brothers and sisters. And Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission has asked Canadians to honor the truth of our nation's history in order to work towards future reconciliation. And part of that is offering land acknowledgments. And while Nexus, of course, we don't own land, we don't own a building, we do meet together and live in places where the traditional homes of Indigenous people were. So this morning, I want to remind us, the place that Nexus meets at, whether it's here, whether it's at the Conrad Center, it's situated on the Haldimand Track. Land that was promised to the Haudenosaunee of the Six Nations of the Grand River is within the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee, Anishinaabe, and Neutral people. And so I think we have to recognize, appreciate their historic connection to this land and place and our ability to be working and living here now. Water Legion, Ontario, Canada, it's a direct result of policies of expulsion, assimilation of our Indigenous peoples during the time of settlement confederation. And those policies are still harming, being felt in many Indigenous communities today. And so I think it's worth saying from time to time, we are grateful for the opportunity to meet here. And I think I want to affirm the challenge of Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Report. And I realize land acknowledgments are just one small step in doing that. But finally, concerning land itself, when you jump forward in Scripture, what I find interesting about the Apostle Paul is he seems to take the idea of land to a whole other level. In fact, he suggests that land itself has a form of consciousness. In Romans 8, I think perhaps one of the greatest chapters in all of Scripture, Paul says this, "The creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as children, the redemption of our bodies." And oh man, I think this passage is rich. Creation is waiting for God's children to show their faces and start working alongside God to liberate it from bondage and decay. Waiting for God's children to show up. And so creation has this own consciousness of its own. It's longing to be free, to be redeemed, to be made new. So creation, this image is groaning. Groaning, eagerly waiting as we are for the future hope of the world. Have you ever heard the earth groan? I was at the cottage, Kristen's family cottage in the winter, and the ice, I don't know if it was expanding or not expanding, but I found myself there at night and I was like alone and these wicked guttural sounds. And I was freaked out. I thought, something's coming to get me. So I wandered down in the dark towards the lake. And there the ice just groaning. Guttural sounds. Shaking the whole land. It was a magical moment. It was also terrifying to hear the sound of ice compressed. I like to imagine that's how our earth feels right now. Groaning. Groaning. And today, of course, creation is groaning even more so than when Paul first penned these words, of course. And the truth is this, you know, I get there are a lot of complicated and important questions and challenges around climate change. But truth be told, I can only hope better minds than mine are working on that. But this passage says something to me, speaks to me. Creation waits for God's children to reveal themselves. Show up. Do something about it. What are we supposed to do? In my limited understanding, I want to close this morning by offering questions rather than answers, because I think questions are often better, but, and I suppose they're a bit leading, but four questions specifically. First, could we humbly admit that maybe our concept of land is impoverished and in need of correction? Could we maybe humbly admit we have a lot to learn from Scripture when it comes to land? Could we humbly admit we have a lot to learn about land from our indigenous communities? Could we maybe consider the fact or the idea that maybe what we're doing to land through the lens of Facebook and Instagram and social media, maybe it's not harmless? Maybe there's something deeper going on there. Perhaps it showcases just how impoverished our idea of land really is. Second, could we all pursue becoming the Andy Goldsworthys of our own time and space? Talked about Andy Goldsworthy a couple weeks ago, this artist who simply works with what he has around him and simply makes things beautiful. Could we at least adopt that mentality with our neighborhoods, our streets, that I will care for this piece of land around me? The Nexus Kids next week are painting rocks. They're going to set them at certain points in the community. A wonderful illustration of just how to make something beautiful and add to the creation around us. I think there's something about that. Simply saying, hey, I've been entrusted with this piece of land, this neighborhood, this street. I can do my part there. Third, last week I talked about how the primary question of the Old Testament that it was asking of itself was this: how did we get here? And as a community, what they were asking themselves is, how did things turn out like this? We find ourselves in calamity after calamity after calamity. How did we get here? And of course, the tragedy of the book is that by the time you get around to asking yourself, how did we get here, it's actually maybe too late to change course. By the time you're asking yourself that question, how did I get here, changing course might not be an option. And so my question for us, in terms of thinking about land, might be this: can we afford to wait until trouble comes for us personally? Can we afford to wait until we're asking ourselves and our country and our world, how did we get here? What will we say to our children and grandchildren when they ask us, how did we get here? How did we end up in this place? What will we say? Can we afford to wait until that question becomes personal for us? Does it have to hit home before we ask ourselves, how did we get here? And if it does take that, it might be too late. But finally, Romans 8 reminds us, though, that the Christian story is a story of hope, of liberation from bondage and decay. It's a story of hope in which God promises to redeem and make all things new. And so no matter how dark it seems, can we hold on to hope? And ask Dave and Ben to come and close us with a song. But can we trust that we humans are not the only or principal players in the story of our world? Because again, like last week, if it's up to us, then maybe it is too late. And there's certainly things for us to do. But can we trust the Christian story of hope? That at the end of the day, this story is not only about us. We're not the only players in the story. There's something, another kingdom at work in this world. And so, Dave and I just discovered this song this week, and I think it might be interesting if we could learn this song, because it's a beautiful reminder. It's very also easy as well, but I think it reminds us not only of the beauty of creation, but our trust in something bigger than ourselves. And so, Dave, I'll give this to you, and I'll come up after you and close in prayer.